Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, K Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. And now, for the next 20 minutes or so, Kevin Herr will get depressed.
That's right. We had my moment earlier. We talked a little racing, talked a little IndyCar. Now you can talk about the business of sports and why everything actually does happen in sports. It's a fair, fair that way.
Brandon and I did talk business.
Yes, you did.
That was the vast majority of that conversation.
I do like, though, his comment was, you know, break even. You know, I do like that. I mean, it's nice to know that it's not always about making a profit. Sometimes breaking even is good too. I like that.
Well, you know, but you know what? You don't want to lose your shirt on it either.
No,
and you want
not.
To be able to, if you can break even on it, you then maybe set up a small profit margin down the road, because then people are excited and then get interested and like the date and so forth. All right, so that's, you know, from a business point of view, it's fine. Speaking of the business of it, Tony Knopp, CEO, Spotlight Ticket Management from Los Angeles. Hello, Tony. Welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
How are you? Hope you guys had a good New Year.
Yeah, we did. Thanks so much. It's great to have you back. The Super Bowl coming up next week, and people said, boy, I'd love to go to a Super Bowl once in my life. Not exactly the most dynamic of experience, is it?
No, you know, it's interesting. First world problems, I guess, that I've been to a number of them. It's if it's your home team and it's somebody you really care about, you should probably go once and experience it and see it. But there's a lot going on around the game, a lot of traffic, very, very crowded, very, very expensive. And the one thing people don't understand is that those commercials that you're enjoying at home, we don't see them at the game.
Right.
So it's a 5-hour football game with a lot of breaks. Not only that, 70% of the crowd is from other teams. So it's a very unique experience for people. It's not a normal football game that most would know, especially, you know, in your guys' country where it's such a vibrant atmosphere in the Big Ten.
Right. Well, exactly. We're at an interesting point right now in sports, and we've talked about the influence of television. So, as you just mentioned, you don't get to see all the commercials that everyone else at home is enjoying. Also, at the same time, you get to enjoy it on a 50, 60, 70-inch big-screen HD TV now. So how important is it for those in positions of authority looking at their stadiums, their arenas, their leagues, to have a long-term vision to get people into seats versus a short-term, I need cash now vision?
It's the future of our industry, and we're seeing it in a lot of different ways. So the Super Bowl is unique in that what Jerry Jones has done in Dallas and what people are doing around the NHL, for example, is about to do a test pilot where they're going to start showing away games at movie theaters.
Right.
So that you can get together with a lot of your friends and you can cheer and have that experience of being able to celebrate with somebody next to you. I mean, as nice as it is to watch it at your house on a 62-inch flat screen and maybe with a neighbor, there's a lot to be said for having 10 rabid fans around you that are strangers that you can hug, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the theory that a lot of these leagues and teams are taking is, well, okay, Jerry Land, AT&T Stadium down there is massive, but we have this huge TV, and you get to be a part of the ambiance. You get to be a part of the experience. For example, they had a big boxing fight down there 4 or 5 years ago. Manny Pacquiao fought Josh Claudi.
Right,
and they
remember
were selling
that.
Tickets
yep.
for 10 bucks, right?
Right.
And you can't see a boxing match from the third deck, but they weren't trying to get you to. They were saying, come watch it on the massive TV and be a part of the atmosphere. That's what they're going to try to push over the next few years, and it'll be interesting to see if they're successful with it. The problem is the Super Bowl will never be successful with that, because if you're trying to sell ambiance, atmosphere, and common fans, you don't have any of those things in the Super Bowl.
Big picture now. I mean, let's take – I've been mentioning the Tampa Bay Buccaneers during this. the Tampa Bay Buccaneers know they're going to get $125 to $135 million from TV. They know they have a radio package that probably nests them another 10, whatever. Between just outside influence, that's $150 million.
Yep.
What do they need to think about as an example to the NFL, as an example to the Miami Heat, as an example to the Dallas Cowboys, to the University of Michigan, whomever, about what they need to do with people, getting people into stadiums or arenas, Tony, that has a 5-10 year feel to it, so you have a that where you're not going for the quick cash.
Yeah, I mean, what they need to look at is, are you going to be an opponent for life? Are you going to be the Washington Generals for life? Because the one thing, as much as you want to be able to say, and it is true that parity creates excitement and parity creates the opportunity for every market to get involved, the downside of parity is that it creates the ability for a team to just not compete and not care.
Right.
I mean, the Tampa Bay Bucks are going to be able to say, look, we don't care if our fans show up or not. You're going to watch us on TV because you've got four of the guys on our team on your fantasy league. Right. So we don't, I mean, we'll let somebody else fight this battle, and we'll just collect checks all day long. We don't even have to sell our own merchandise. Right. So I don't know if the NFL has yet figured that out. As much as they say they have the greatest business model out there, I don't think they're doing enough to separate the haves and the have-nots. Not by money, but by the people who are really pushing that limit, who are focused on the long term, are making sure that they have a viable business in a viable region. And I think what's finally going to make that tip is eventually there's going to be enough moving around of teams, and you're finally going to have a city say, maybe we don't want one, right? And if that's 5 years or 10 years or 15 years from now, and that's when we're all going to realize, okay, this might be an issue. We need to find a way to build a fan and make that fan somebody who interacts with us locally as a team, as opposed to just saying, well, go NFL, you know, interact with the NFL, and we'll just be somebody who collects checks because we're part of it.
What league actually has a vision, in your opinion, that actually is looking as a forward thinker? You said the NFL claims to have the best business model, but may not. Who might?
The NBA, across the board. So the NBA
had a
gentleman, and they actually had a few guys from there that are spread around the country. But what they have is they have a thing they call team marketing and business operations. It's a team of people in the NBA offices. They're a bunch of MBAs. They're a bunch of, you know, a bunch of nerds like me who sit around and go from team to team to team, and they take the best practice at every team. They go and they see. So if they were in the NFL, they'd go see what the Green Bay Packers are doing, and they bring it down to the Tampa Bay Bucks. And the NFL is starting to do that. They're starting to build a team to go that direction. But the NBA has really trailblazed this, and it's really helping. You're starting to see that, you know, these teams are starting to mimic one another and copy best practices. And the most interesting thing about it is the most forward-thinking teams on the business side generally win on the court, too. The San Antonio Spurs are one of the most well-respected run businesses, regardless of whether they win or not. And it's not a surprise that it leads over to the court.
Very interesting. What did they do that makes them fan-friendly, that gets people? Now, they win. All right, that's obvious. I mean, they win.
But they're also in that boat where they've been winning for such a long time that it creates a little bit of lackadaisical fan, right? Like the Atlanta Braves had that problem. You win your division for 14 years, and the fans stop coming because it's not a unique experience. And that's something that the Spurs have had to deal with. And what the Spurs do is they're always looking for a different experience, and they're very, very involved in the community. If you come to play for the San Antonio Spurs, you're going to be a part of this community. And if you're not, then you don't play for the San Antonio Spurs. Right, that's how they approach it, and it's really helped them build this business that is as loyal to them as they are to their community, and it's why they're so successful. They also, what's very interesting about the Spurs, they actually incentivize their staff to move the needle. So these all the teams get together, and they meet in the NBA offices, and they have new ideas that they've done, and the NBA picks the five top ideas of the year, and they make those best practices that they're not going to focus on for the other teams next year. Well, the Spurs employees actually get a bonus if they come up with one of those and it gets named to be a best practice across the league. They actually get a big check, bonus check, for doing it. And so what you're doing is you're incentivizing innovation, right? And I can see that happening more and more in the NBA, especially with owners like Steve Ballmer from Microsoft taking over the Clippers, or Vivek Ranadiva taking over at the Sacramento Kings. And we all know the very loud, outspoken technology owner down in Dallas.
There's certain brand loyalty that's critical in sports. For example, Penn State fans are a loyal lot.
Oh, yeah.
Ohio State fans, Michigan fans, University of Texas fans, loyal. How difficult is it for pro teams to get that kind of mass loyalty?
Well, I think what you see is you're not seeing that loyalty roll over into the expansion teams we've seen because it hasn't crossed that generational gap. You didn't have the ability to do it, right? You had the Carolina Panthers show up and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you know, well, they're not that new, but the Carolina Panthers show up, you have the Florida Marlins, you have all these new teams that showed up. And some of them had success. You know, the San Jose Sharks did a really good job. But a lot of the other ones, they really were looking to make money almost immediately, and you didn't appeal to the average fan. You didn't appeal to that fan who could bring their kids, and then, you know, for every fan you get, you've got three new ones. So right. A very interesting quote. I was at a sports business forum last week, and Lou Robitaille, president of the Kings and the CEO of the Ducks, were talking. And they were saying that every new youth hockey participant that they can bring in to the sport means 3.5 new fans for the team. Right? That's what they're focused on.
Right.
How do we make this fan part of it? And what's really interesting is somebody asked them, well, you just told us that you're sold out 97% of the time and that the fans can't get there, but then you said it's necessary for them to come see the game to be a fan. So that's what the teams are doing. Is they're really making an idea out of how do we make this accessible, forego some revenue today, knowing that that revenue is going to be there in the future when LeBron James is gone, because I grew up with my dad watching the Miami Heat. That's simply not the case with the Miami Heat. It's not the case with the Carolina Panthers or the Miami Marlins or most of those expansion teams.
Very interesting, because what's happened is, and I'll give you an example. I grew up in New England. And finally, people caught on to the Whalers in Connecticut, because Connecticut had never had a team. But it took a while for them to, you know, a Ranger fan to say, all right, I'll follow the Whalers. A Bruins fan, I'll follow the Whalers. What happens is you have fans in the area that already had deep-seated loyalty someplace else.
Exactly. And you have to try to change that loyalty. My business partner here lives in Washington, D.C., and he's a Phillies fan. His kids are Nats fans, but it's just not the same because he roots for the Phillies. And that's the thing, is you have to try to find a way to convert those families and make it a generational thing, make it something that's a commonality between all of us so that we experience it and we enjoy it. And there just haven't been a lot of franchises that have done it. And it doesn't mean there's not hope for it. Significant success in San Jose, right? You can always point to things like Winnipeg and say, well, the Jets have been really healthy. Well, yeah, but they had a team not that long ago, and they're not really building a new market, right? San Jose Sharks didn't have a team, and they are a vibrant hockey market. A place where there's no ice anywhere.
Right.
So, and they do fantastically. You go to those games, people do not get up during the game. They're sold out, and they are avid Sharks fans. So it is possible, but they did it the right way. They made it accessible for the family. They went out into the community. They got involved in the community. They made their players accessible, even when they were awful. And that's what builds a fan base. Right? Selling people tickets for as much as they can bear doesn't build a fan base.
So you're saying that the Oakland/California Golden Seals didn't...
Exactly. I like that reference. Old Steel Park.
White skates.
and that's what we're going to see next with, you know, if we ever see an NFL team that gets turned down somewhere, right? If they bounced around a couple of times and show no success in different markets, the NFL has to make sure that their markets are feasible before they're going into them. And I think they swung and missed on a few of those. The NHL has definitely swung and missed on a few of those.
Sure.
And they're trying to backtrack on it. And, you know, what the Gila River Casino Arena now, it's like the third name they've had.
Right.
It's across
the street.
At some point, you just think common sense jumps in and says, you know what, maybe hockey in Phoenix isn't a good idea.
Right, exactly. That, by the way, that arena is across the street from the University of Phoenix Stadium.
Right next to it.
Yeah. I want to get to the Las Vegas thing for a moment. The NBA has been very open over the years saying, you know, Las Vegas might be a very intriguing idea. But the NHL has now jumped in full bore with the idea of four expansion teams, and Las Vegas is at or near the top, and they think they could command $445 million as an expansion fee to get them in.
Yep. They're very open. I mean, the team presidents are saying there will be a team in Las Vegas in the next 2 years.
You and I both know that the unemployment rate in Nevada is very high,
yep,
and Las Vegas is a transient community. Can this work?
I don't think so. But there are a lot smarter people than me saying that it can, and they've already got the arena laid out. MGM has put a ton of money into it, and they're going to have a bunch of opportunities to, you know, try to bring in other business while they're there. But I just don't see that as something that's going to take off and be a vibrant market. I can see it being another Phoenix. You know, even Anaheim, which was such a vibrant franchise for such a long time, really came across some harder times. And they're doing okay recently, but they're certainly not, you know, what I would call a vibrant hockey market. And that's even with a lot of people that they can draw from in a very large community that's doing relatively well. You know, Las Vegas's economics right now don't look all that attractive, and we're in the middle of a bubble boom, so to speak. So I think they're going to do it. I hope they learn from their experiences in the past and make it a nice small arena. But, I mean, hey, if your fans want to go see what it looks like to catch a Florida Panthers game, I think you'd be surprised by how few people actually attend them.
Yeah.
I mean, they've actually blocked off, and that stadium fits about 18,000. They've blocked off down to 12,000 seats with advertisements. You couldn't buy them if you wanted to.
In Broward County.
And that's in inside in an arena. I mean, we've seen them do that before in large outdoor stadiums like the L.A. Coliseum, and the Oakland Raiders do it. Use the excuse that it's a baseball park. But we've never seen that in arenas before.
Boston, of course, is the United States entry for the 2024 Olympics. There is now talk that it might go to a vote. And the taxpayer, you and I both know the taxpayers are going to tell them, no way, get it out.
No way, yep, not enough.
No chance. There's no chance at all. This will be Denver 1976 all over again. People forget that in 1970, Denver got the Olympics for 76, and in 72, the voters said, we're not paying for that.
Yeah, no way.
And it went to Innsbruck. So if it goes to a vote, it's going to get crushed. Explain to me any economic benefit to having an Olympic Games. Where?
You know, it's interesting. So Peter Ueberroth's pretty open about his experience there and what he did in 1984.
Brilliant.
When they brought the games in there. I mean, unequivocally, the United States is the ones who are responsible for corporatizing the games. They did it in 1984. They found a way to make money, because prior to that, it had just been accepted that the Olympics was a giant cash hole that you threw a bunch of money into and nothing ever came out of it. The reality is you build a bunch of infrastructure into a city that probably doesn't need it. Go visit, you know, Park City sometime or Salt Lake City, and you can see plenty of infrastructure that's not being used. Right now, there really isn't much of a case for the Olympics being a cash boon for anybody. I mean, if you look what's been happening in Brazil, if you look what's been happening in Beijing, if you look what's been happening in facilities that they have in Salt Lake City and Park City, it's a giant cash hole. I would be surprised if it actually does happen in Boston. If it does go to vote, it's going to get absolutely crushed. And the problem is you have these corrupt governments that don't mind pouring that kind of money into it.
Right.
You know, Russia and Sochi was such a joke. They were paying 10x what they should for anything just so they could, you know, scratch businesses' backs and make sure they're getting favors in return. There's just not a lot of value in having the Olympic Games anymore.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is that, you know, Russia threw all that money in, and the price of oil, which is their chief export, went from 110 to 40.
Yeah, they're not doing so hot right now, and that's unfortunately going to create some political unrest. But the reality is you have, you know, oil barons, you have, you know, different spots in the globe that have money to burn right now, and that's why they're going to see the World Cup in Qatar, and that's why we're going to see we saw the Sochi Games. It's just not something I think the United States is going to be involved in.
Okay, I always want to get to you. Here it is, January. Tony, hot buys, not so hot buys. And now I know soccer will be a hot buy. So hot buy, not so hot buys right now.
Everything, you know what? Everything is really hot right now. It's
really?
Corporations have opened up their purse strings. The Super Bowl, I think, is going to be a higher price than we've seen in the last 6 or 7 years. I still think there's going to be some somewhat affordable tickets, but I don't think we're going to see them come down to where they've been in the past. I could see the Masters being a very hot ticket this year. Dustin Johnson coming back, Rory McIlroy coming around. I think the Tiger factor has kind of played its hand now.
Interesting.
It's been interesting to see. The one thing I think is going to be really hot is the San Francisco Super Bowl. They haven't had it since 1984, and I believe 84.
Yeah,
they had it at Sanford Stadium.
Yeah, they did. It was the Dolphins Niners game. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, Roger Craig. That's right. And they. You know, the reality is they're pouring a lot of money into whatever they can in infrastructure there in the Bay Area. There's a lot of money there. It's a tech bubble. Everybody's doing really, really great. I think the Super Bowl next year is going to be very expensive and very, I think they're going to go above and beyond with the entertainment and what we're going to see. Right. It's going to be a very hot ticket. I usually wouldn't say that about the Super Bowl. I mean, the last few years it's been dropping. I mean, New York was not popular, and New Orleans, you know, we've all been there. And Phoenix, you know, it'll do well this year, but we were just there in 2008.
Right. Well, they better get the field straightened out, because that stadium has had five fields since they opened it. Five.
Well, they had the Denham Field. I don't know if you saw that when Levi's laid the they laid their jeans out and covered up the whole field.
I'll be frank with you, that may have been the best one they had.
Maybe they can play on that.
Yeah. Does Rob Manfred get it as the baseball commissioner about what they need to do? And when you talk to your corporate partners,
I think so. I still think they're trying to backtrack on some things like secondary ticketing. You know, trying to make it
right,
so that they can control where their tickets are going. I think that that has already passed. It's time to focus on new things. That battle's, you know, starting to be won. But I see the right things happening. I mean, look, I'm not going to make any friends saying that I thought that this past Commissioner Selig was not a good one, and I don't think he was. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the bar is very high for him.
That's what they said about the when I took over the show.
No, I'm just kidding. Exactly. Right.
Tony, it is always a pleasure. Enjoy the Super Bowl and all the dullness of sitting there for 5 hours while
right,
some ball boy protects the football.
I know. Unbelievable. We'll see how it plays out. Should be a good game.
Yeah, thanks so much. Tony, it's great. Happy New Year to you.
All right. You too. We'll talk soon.
Tony Knopf, CEO, Spotlight Ticket Management. Kevin, depression. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
While looking for a vehicle, you know that if it sounds too good to be true, chances are it is too good to be true. You get the runaround, gotta go from place to place. Well, you can just skip all of that and go straight to Sunbury Motor Company. Sunbury Motor Company has been satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915, so you know they've got it right. No offers that look good on paper or online, and then you get disappointed when you see them in person. Sunbury Motor Company offers a lineup few other auto dealers in the area can compete with. With the inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there will be no problem finding the right vehicle that fits your needs and your budget. And the friendly, knowledgeable staff's ready and able to help you with everything from the test drive to the drive off the lot. See for yourself at Sunbury Motors. Sunbury Motors Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. And Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Look for them online anytime at sunburymotors.com.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Tom Brady's addressing the media right now, the quarterback for the New England Patriots. And we're now at the point of the press conference where we're re-asking the same question 17 times, but we want to make sure that our news director heard our voice ask the question.
And it's the same question, just worded slightly different.
Exactly. He handled himself very well, which you would expect. Look, who knows what happened with this thing? You know what?
Well, somebody does.
Yeah, but who knows?
I understand what you're saying, but somebody definitely knows what's going on.
Yeah, I understand that, but you know what? Unless they can find money changing hands, like right, Brad Johnson paying $7,500 to the ball boys to deflate them or whatever, I don't know.
Well, like I said, just find out what former ball boy has some really good seats next year.
Right. But for example, I mean, something not one of us would think of. I would never think of this. I've never once asked Christian Hackenberg, do you like a heavy ball, a light ball, an inflated ball, deflated ball? Not one quarterback here have I ever asked that question to, ever. You know, to me, a football's a football. Have you ever heard this issue brought up, ever?
No. Never.
Of course, nobody has. It's like with Belichick. Belichick's earlier today. I don't know. I got bigger things to worry about. And he does. You're trying to run a football game.
Well, let's see. Brady said that he did not alter the footballs.
He says he goes through and he says there are certain footballs that feel great to him. He goes through a process, whatever. I guess he picked out 24.
Yeah, here's his comment on that.
I didn't, you know, have any, I didn't alter the ball in any way. I have a process that I go through before every game where I go in and I pick the balls that I want to, the footballs that I want to use for the game. Our equipment guys do a great job of breaking the balls in. You know, they have the process that they go through. When I pick those footballs out, at that point, you know, to me, they're perfect.
I guess the only question I do have is why do we have a team ball? Now, I know they do this at all levels. I understand that. But wouldn't it avoid this issue if there was one set of balls for both teams used it and that's all there was?
Well, all right. In the NFL, you can do that because they have one sponsor.
Right.
But, for example, in college football, you really can't.
That's a great point.
Penn State's a Nike school.
Well,
Penn State's a Nike school. It's going to be a Nike ball. If you go over to Michigan, it's going to be an Adidas ball. And that's the difference right there. And that's why you need to have your own ball. You're bringing with them. It's what you're used to. It also allows you to bring footballs with you that you're used to using all the time, and it's your ball. You're on the road to begin with. I think that's more of a, to me, that's more of a road team factor than a home team factor.
I understood that, and I understand that when it comes to college because of that, and I kind of figured that's what you were going to say. Obviously, that's not a problem for the NFL. And I can tell you one thing, it's not a problem for the PIAA because everybody's using the same brand there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, it was the AFL that brought the Duke in. That was the name of the ball, the Duke. And the reason why the AFL went with the Duke back in the 60s was because of it was easier to throw. And the AFL wanted to have a throwing game. The NFL ball was a little more round. You know, I mean, still in the shape of a football, but a little plumper back in the 50s and 60s. And the AFL went with the Duke because the Duke, he said, you could really throw it. Joe Namath loved throwing that ball, he said. And eventually that's what they adopted in the NFL. Look, you have 12.5 to 13.5, so you have a leeway that goes with it, all right? Well, obviously Brady wants them at the 12.5. And you know that's the answer he's going to give, is that he wants the ball at the 12.5. Well, 12.5 happens to be legal. These footballs ended up being under. But they won the game 45-7. They did not win the game 17-14.
What if the game was 17-14, though? Would this be more of an issue, and would we be talking about it in a different way?
Then it becomes a bigger deal. But the fact the game was 45-7, and really, the Colts were never in the game.
Well, at the opening kickoff, shortly thereafter, it ended.
Yeah, right. I mean, did they score to make it, 14-7? They scored to make it 14-7. But after that, I mean, the Patriots ran off 31 unanswered points. I'm sorry, the football had nothing to do with it because they were running LeGarrette Blount. You know, Vereen had a good game. Last week they're talking about Patriot formations and are they legal or not, and they are legal. You know, every week there's something else with this team where people are trying to look at something. And again, I'm not a Patriots fan. Never been a Patriots fan. I mean, when I grew up, and the reason that people have asked me why I'm not a Patriots fan, remember Tony Knopp and I were just talking about loyalties and how difficult it is for expansion teams to develop a loyalty because you already have fans with deep-seated feelings about teams. There's a lot of people have moved to Florida, for example, that never warmed up to the Tampa Bay Rays but couldn't wait for the Yankees or the Red Sox to come into town because that's their team. Well, that's what you grew up with. That's why the long-standing, deep-seated teams are like that. Well, I grew up in the 60s. You know, I mean, I was, you know, when in 1969, I'm 11 years old. Well, the Patriots were the Boston Patriots, and they were in the AFL. And the NFL, despite the fact that the Jets and the Chiefs eventually won Super Bowls 3 and 4 respectively, the NFL was the dominant league. It was the league. And, well, when I was growing up in the league, the New York Giants were actually the local team for me. Well, I've always been a Giants fan. I've never been a Patriots fan. Never have. And I know they've won and so forth. I respect them and so forth. So what I'm talking about here, I have no allegiance to this team at all. It's not like you talking about the Steelers where, I mean, because the Steelers are in a little hot water right now too, as a matter of fact, over a different issue. Their chief of security. And that's a problem. It actually may be, to me, even a bigger problem. And when you look at this as an example, is it cheating? Yes. But at the same time, as a head football coach, you think Belichick's over there, we got the deflated balls, we're in good shape today. Well, he's trying to run a game.
Well, it still didn't stop the New England Patriots from out-blocking or actually blocking effectively, Colts.
They crushed this team. And on the other side, the Colts had their 13.5 IPS footballs, and Andrew Luck had a bad night. That's their football. And the Patriots stopped them at all turns. They could get nothing. Reggie Wayne was virtually shut out. T.Y. Hilton couldn't do anything. I mean, that's the one saving grace for the Patriots in all this is that they not only won the game, they crushed them.
Now, what's this thing about the Steelers? So, I missed this one.
Oh, the Steelers have a problem.
Well, yeah, it's called the secondary, but I'm assuming you're talking about something different.
No, it deals with their head of security.
I missed this story. Yeah, I missed this story.
Yeah, well, that's a shame.
Maybe I conveniently missed it.
They're debating the dual role of their security that they refer to as their security fixer. And this is a problem. And then they bring up the story of Mike Adams. And when Mike Adams was bleeding from a stab wound, disoriented, and he said, I got to tell you this, I'm a Pittsburgh Steeler. And they said, we don't care, I'll leave the occupation blank if you want. Well, later he filled out his report, and the officer indeed left Adams' occupation blank. Pittsburgh police, though, extended even greater courtesy to Adams when the team, in June of 2013, another officer called to the scene was Lieutenant Jack Kearney, longtime point man for the Steelers, known as the Cleaner. And Kearney is a high-ranking Allegheny County Sheriff's Officer, has been since 2001. Or has been for a long time, and then since 2001 he's been the head of security for the Steelers. And to me, that's a problem. That's a conflict of interest. And he answers to Art Rooney II.
This sounds like an outside the line story.
This is a problem story. This is an outside the line
story. No, I'm just saying it sounds like something that would have been reported on Outside the Lines, and I missed it.
Yep. I mean, and this, you know, I mean, I realize it has nothing to do with, you know, with Jerome Bettis getting to the Hall of Fame, thus you would have bypassed it, but I mean.
It's not as sexy as underinflated balls.
I don't think I would have phrased it that way. All right, we'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. I mean, the integrity of the game is obviously very important. And there's no getting around that. And, you know, what's interesting is that when you're talking about a quarterback or a kicker, for example, well, quarterbacks and kickers want an exact feel to the ball as to their specifications. That's why, for example, Aaron Rodgers likes the ball to be fully inflated at 13.5. He does not like when the ball has any kind of deflation in it as he goes through a football game. And he's talked about that. You know that Eli Manning, for example, laces are a specific length and a specific width on a football. But there's no real deal on the specific height of a lace. Well, he likes higher laces on a ball because he feels he can spin the ball better and it's a better feel for him. Some quarterbacks really like to have a football roughed up, just like you see, for example, a baseball pitcher will get a ball and they will then scuff the ball up. They'll rub that ball up and get it so it's got a little, it's not as slick. Some quarterbacks like to have the ball slick. Some don't. You know, some like the dimples on the ball to be a little bit higher because they can grip it and spin it better. Some like to have it in such a way where they like to have it slide out of their hand, so they like to have it to be a slick, fast surface on it.
Wait. You can get a ball that has raised laces? Like, you can order it that way, or bigger dimples, or however? You can actually get it that way?
Oh, yeah. Sure you can.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Sure you can. It's a football. You can have them shipped in any way you want. I mean, it's just, you know, it's what they like. And Manning will go through a series and he'll say, I like the feel of that one. This is Eli Manning. I like the feel of that one. I like the feel of that one. Now that one, you know, it's too flat. It's not going to come out of my hand right. It's all about feel, comfort, confidence when you do it. There's no question about that. I've never asked Christian Hackenberg, never even thought to ask him. Hey, by the way, you know, you like the ball, you know, heavily inflated, deflated, laces that. Just watch him throw the thing around. It never even crossed my mind. And all the time, now I'll tell you, in basketball, for example, in basketball, you use a different ball all the time. Some teams have an Adidas ball, some teams have the Nike ball. And then there's a ball called the Rock. And, for example, the ball used in the NIT is different than the ball that you use during the course of the regular season. You do have to get used to it. And there is a different feel to each one as to each company that puts it out. Again, not an issue in the NFL because they're all using the same brand name football. So that's not an issue. In college, it is an issue. It is definitely an issue. And in basketball, you do not bring your own ball with you. You never do. And the reason you don't is because you only use one in the game and both teams have to use it. So you use the one that comes off the rack of the other team. And, you know, usually it's the point guard that makes that pick during shoot-around. This is the ball. Let's play with this one. Okay. And remember, in the NFL, these footballs allegedly were inspected before the game by Walt Anderson and his crew, and they're supposed to be marked. Now, do we find out that maybe they were lackadaisical in what they were doing? Has anybody ever brought that up? Oh, yeah, they're all fine. Haven't heard anybody mention that. Like, they changed out the one to start the second half, which was brought up in the press conference, but that's after it was brought up to them at halftime about the other one. And they did that. Well, after that, they seemed to be fine with everything they were putting into the game after they were, quote, made aware of it at halftime. I'm wondering if part of this is that, they all seem fine to me. You know, that something tells me they may not have checked it before the game either. How about that as an explanation? We've done this 1,000 times. They all look like real footballs to us.
That's like in baseball, checking the bats for to make sure they're legal, which is something they do in every division. After you do it so many times, you just kind of glance over it.
Right. And you got to wonder, I think it was Wally Anderson was the referee of this game, right? You're going to wonder if maybe his crew kind of like, that's all good. Then they may be aware of it at halftime, and then they changed out the one to start the second half. Well, you notice they didn't change out another ball the rest of the game. Did you notice that?
You mean the usual whatever. Oh, you mean in an unusual moment, change out the ball.
Yeah, the start of the second half, they changed out the ball.
Right.
Remember,
yes.
Mike, Mike Carey said that might be a K-ball,
right,
which it wasn't. Well, this, of course, remember, they were made aware at halftime that the balls might be underinflated. So they started the second half, and they changed out the football. They didn't stop play at any other point the rest of the game to change out a football. And I'm wondering, now again, they're supposed to have possession of the footballs, what, 2 hours and 15 minutes before the game against something I never knew. Right, I'm wondering that, yeah, okay, we're fine. Yeah, we're all good. Now, as professionals and as arbiters of the game, I guess you expect them to go through, but, you know, after you go through something 1,000 times, okay, there's their footballs where I'll say, yeah, Colts, because they were good.
Well, we heard from the
now,
coach.
Okay, that is a distinct possibility. You haven't heard from the league as to, okay, how long they had possession of it. Did they actually check it before the game? What were the specifications before the game? You know, why were the referees, officials so comfortable with the ball they had? Okay, how long was it before the ball boy ended up with it? Blah, blah, you know, it's like,
well,
you got cameras all over the place in these places too, you know.
That's what I was just going to say. We've heard from the coach. We've heard from the quarterback. We really haven't heard from the NFL on, A, what they feel this should be, whether there's, you know, if it's an issue or not. And we also haven't heard from the NFL whether they're going to have an investigation, have we?
Well, the NFL has been investigating. That's what this has all been
okay,
about.
Okay, so there is an investigation going on by the NFL.
Sure, there.
Okay.
Well, there has
well, see,
been,
I haven't heard anybody specifically say that. That's why I wondered.
Right, the NFL's been investigating. They've been looking into it. That's why, for example, you know, they say that they don't really say too much more because they're cooperating with the investigation. But you know, at the same time, you know, the Super Bowl's coming up. You know, I mean, are we going to be literally... I mean, this is an integrity issue. Figure it out, all right, which is very important. But for goodness sakes, you know.
Well, you know, they have 6 hours of pregame to fill. This is going to give them at least a good 2 hours.
Of which I
you
will
won't watch
how many minutes?
Exactly.
Never. I don't want, you know what? I know it's what I do for a living, but I don't like seeing gibberish. They don't talk enough about the game. It's like, yeah. All right, we'll talk to you tomorrow.